go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. It is the 17th day of November 2014. And this particular 17th day of November 2014 is shaping up to feel a hell of a lot more like, you know, the 19th of January 2015. By that I mean low temperatures are expected here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cole, Virginia, to drop below 20 this evening, which is a big deal for us and makes other people say, ah, sissies. Yeah, well, anyway, you slice it. I ain't ready for it. Below tomorrow night, I think, is like 11. And I don't like this. It makes keeping things even reasonably warm here rather difficult. And this meant there's going to be a lot of propane burnt around here this winter. Damn. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And that's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room. Nice crowd gathering in there even as we speak. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, News Ninja Carol Baker. Good evening, Devin. Good evening, Doctor Who and Jan and Jerry and Jeremy. Good evening, John Fox. Good evening, Lance. Good evening, Michael. Good evening, Mr. Gibson. Good evening, Ron, and good evening to longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator, Sparky. And, of course, you too can be there. Hey, and there's Lottie. Yep. Also a longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator. You, too, can be part of the multimedia real-time extravaganza palooza that is the Horn chat room, if you will but wander by. It's free and it's easy at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. The tab is there at the top of the page. It says chat room, and bang, there you go. Oh, let's see. Where to begin? Oh, I know. I got this. I want to extend congratulations right off the bat to our buddy Mark over the weekend. Mark availed himself of the Hooterville Holler Tasty Collection Gift Ensemble, hand-gathered by Carol Baker, which will be heading out in short order, I have no doubt. Also, this evening, you know that we try to raise $150 per evening for the purpose of funding the program here. And I want to let you know that we have a show on me this evening, courtesy of Roger. Roger said he would like to have a show on me this evening, and if I would, to please share the following message with you. And this message arises out of the recent attempt at having an election, particularly in the state of Texas. Yeah. Roger writes, chewing on one chunk at a time. interim measure on Texas and similar voter ID rules on unacceptability of veteran ID cards as proof of voter being voter. This has got my ire up. I realize that there aren't that many people, as a percentage of the total population, whose best or most readily accessible ID is their veteran's ID, but this is a group worthy of thoughtful consideration. Whether their treatment at the VA is due to a physical wound, or something less visible, like PTSD, it is not grounds for the state of Texas or any other place to add them to the list of people that they think do not matter. And it's not that they're saying that they don't matter, it's that they just don't need to be voting. If you can't go down to some law enforcement agency in Texas and get yourself a photo ID, as opposed to, say, going to the Bureau of Elections or Commissioner of Elections or county clerk or whoever is in charge of elections in a given county. No. We want them going down to a nice, intimidating place like law enforcement. If anything, that kind of treatment could exacerbate a PTSD, and no one in the real world feels better after being told they don't matter any longer now that they can't go and serve in a foreign war for a corporate agenda. What I propose, says Roger, until such time as the dignity of the person is restored, I would like to ask active duty members of the armed forces, whose ID is considered valid in these localities, to work on restoring dignified treatment of those who served with them or before them. Other groups can mount similar campaigns for their disaffected comrades. When you attend a political function or any place that politicians will be present, do so in uniform. Ask your politicians what their position is on your state's law regarding rejecting veterans' ID for voter ID purposes. Do not tell them what they should say. Ask them to explain on the record what their position is, and there is a significant difference there. Of course, I am of the mind that having to show any kind of photo ID after having already been through the voter registration process is a form of oppression and disenfranchisement. Roger continues and says, please do not wait like the faux opposition groups that pretend to object to laws but always show up with too little too late to make a difference until a few weeks before an election to start doing this. Begin doing it now, not as a special endeavor, but as an adjunct to your current routine. At some point, the squeaky wheel of principle from being reminded that they supported the original bill or have failed to propose fixing the current one should result in corrective legislation well in time for the next election cycle. Thank you for at least considering this. Signed, an old citizen who happens to be an ex-Marine. I didn't know one could be an ex-Marine. I thought one that was one of those things one sort of always was. But let us not quibble over terminology. So thank you, Roger. Thank you very kindly for going forward with a have a show on me, the concept having been introduced by our good friend Ed Kofer. Thank you very much, and it is a worthy subject of the notion that we've now got 2 years to fix some of these things. And in Texas, if they are going to continue disenfranchising people for purposes of voting and saying that a voter ID issued by the VA with a photograph on it is not sufficient proof, well, then that does need to be addressed in a big way. So, yes, we have taken care of fundraising for this evening, and we are into tomorrow's fundraising. And I want to take a moment to thank Jan and Jerry. They have jumped in this evening to keep us going toward tomorrow. You know, getting a day ahead is not exactly some sort of large living. If we wanted to go ahead and get tomorrow or Wednesday or the whole blessed week done or the rest of November, that would be fine. So thank you. Thank you very kindly, Jan and Jerry, and thank you, Roger, for your have a show on me message. And I'd never considered doing anything like that before, but shucks, it's considerable if there is, well, heavens to Betsy. I'll share just about any message. This is a community. But if you would like to tie a message to providing funding for an entire show to someone, or to the Horn Family Commune Congregation, well, that's not a terrible idea. Not a bad one at all. And again, thank you. Thank you very kindly to Roger. Thank yous also, like I said, go out to Mark for availing himself of the Hooterville Holler premium. Now, this is, of course, Moran Monday, and I guess we've been kind of waiting for it for a while. They tend to pile up over the course of the weekend, if you know what I mean. And, where to go? How about, oh goodness, this really is challenging. Any time you get, and understand that this account comes as being pretty much the only thing remotely humorous, pleasant, likely to come out of Ferguson, Missouri for a long time to come. Whatever we're doing this Moran Monday, we're taking the grammar out and giving it a good whopping. We can't not note the actions of Anonymous over the weekend. And toward that end, note the essential moranity of the Ku Klux Klan. Because, as we have been talking about on the program, the Klan have been talking about using lethal force against anyone who dares to protest what looks like a rigged, fixed situation with the grand jury in St. Louis County relative to Darren Wilson, who, let us remember, regardless of the circumstances, gunned down with multiple shots an 18-year-old young man who was unarmed and whose greatest crime appears to have been that of walking in the public road. A sort of enforcement of the old, old racist step-off rule in reverse in the second decade of the 21st century. So it was that with the Klan running their mouths like that, Anonymous, who had been kind of quiet lately, took note of the fact that the Klan had begun to needle them. Hint to Morans, to wit, the Klan, don't needle Anonymous. We're talking here about, among other things, Frank Ancona, who is a part of something called the Traditionalist American Knights of the KKK, whatever that means, who was handing out flyers in St. Louis that contained the words, "We will use lethal force as provided under Missouri law to defend ourselves." Against what? One doesn't know. Well, you know, yeah, we do. It's the Klan. They've been defending themselves against threats that didn't exist for, goodness me, mercy sakes, what, 150 years or so now? Yeah. Maybe a little less. So, yes, I agree, Devin. Anonymous's kung fu is strong. Another note coming from Carol Baker. The Ferguson chief of police tells us that the moment the grand jury passes down a no bill, no true bill, that's what we mean That's what the archaic term that is used whenever we want to talk about someone having their case presented and not being indicted by a grand jury. The Ferguson chief of police tells us that the moment the grand jury passes down a no true bill, Darren Wilson will be reinstated. Keep in mind, he's been on full pay since August, and he's never had to lift a finger. He had, however, been advised against putting a notch on his service revolver, I guess. Yeah. So, with tensions beginning to mount, and with people in the Ferguson area using plywood to board up their windows as if a hurricane was coming to St. Louis, the Ku Klux Klan has been confronted by Anonymous. Anonymous began tracking down information about members of the Klan in the St. Louis area, and they posted some of them via Twitter, at which point the Klan, and this is the hilarious part, started complaining about invasions of privacy. Yes, no, really, the Klan did that thing. Well, our sacred white privacy's done been invaded by them Anonymousers. They done peeked under our pillar cases. So then they decided to start needling Anonymous. Their Twitter handle, by the way, is @KuKluxKlanUSA, saying, among other things, Anonymous is nothing but an act. Don't be worried by this, fellow Klansman. #OpKKK, #HoodsOn. Then they also tweeted, Anonymous is nothing but a bunch of wannabes. They won't take any action. We will not be brought down by some lowlives behind a screen. That should be sufficient provocation for a group of people who are expert at hacking into things. This was followed on Sunday. We are continuing to read anonymous threats with much amusement. Still no action taken. #cowards, #hoodsOn. I don't think it was quite 2 hours after posting that tweet that Anonymous had complete control of the Ku Klux Klan USA Twitter account. Mm-hmm. Posting under Anon control as of 16 November 2014, 09-11-47. You should have expected us. Then they did the ultimate. They posted a photograph of a Klansman hanging from a noose, hoods on, yeah, hooded, of course, with the #OpKKK, and the war is on. Here's the funny part. There are more than twice as many followers of the Klan Twitter account now that Anonymous has control of it. To the extent that anything about this miserable situation can be funny, this is. This absolutely is. But that's about as far as it goes. Because some people, and racists among them, simply can't learn. You know, atne ute aitbre, if you one what I in me. The supporters of Darren Wilson have announced their intent to put up a billboard in Tennessee. Well, okay, the person raising the money is in Tennessee. The billboard they want to put up is somewhere near Ferguson. And this is as a result of a crowdsourcing campaign, which means that there are a number of people who have contributed money to it, thinking that it has some sort of social worth. No, really, not kidding. The person in question is in Brentwood, Tennessee, which is, I believe, a suburb of Nash Vegas. And the person in question, his name is Don Alexander. And Don Alexander, via crowdsourcing, has raised over $3,000, and he intends to, these are advertising companies, so unless it's a billboard for, say, universal health care or women's reproductive rights, they'll take anything, as long as the check clears, anything for a buck. Kind of like CNN. More on that in a minute. What then? Well, the billboard is to... The purpose of the billboard is to put up a phrase that will mock the signature chant, phrase, cry of the previous protests in Ferguson, to wit, hands up, don't shoot. Now, the way Don Alexander of Brentwood, Tennessee, put it at the Indiegogo page, which he set up for purposes of raising this money, this crowdfunding campaign is for the purchase of a billboard in the Ferguson, Missouri area. The billboard will display black text on a white background with the text, hashtag, pants up, don't loot. Oh, he's a clever little Klansman, our Don Alexander of Brentwood, Tennessee. So they've raised enough money to put the billboard up for 1 month. Although Don Alexander says, whatever funds we receive will go directly to keeping the billboard campaign up as long as possible. If we come to an agreement with a company and can fund it for 3 months, 5 months, 7 months, we will. We have to keep the exact billboard company undisclosed because the companies we choose are being targeted with the intention of shutting us down and make it impossible for the project to move forward. By the way, just in case you were wondering how a guy in Brentwood, Tennessee could raise $3,000 for a billboard in Missouri Stan, well, you shouldn't wonder that at all. This is a guy in Brentwood, Tennessee. But anyway, it turns out, and Gawker has the story. Yeah, he has been aided and abetted, if you will, Don Alexander of Brentwood, Tennessee, Stan has, by posters on a site called St. Louis Cop Talk, which is a comment board for police and police fanboys and fangirls in the St. Louis area. Back about 4 days ago, the following was posted at St. Louis Cop Talk. There is an effort to crowdfund a billboard in the Ferguson area against the rioting and looting with the hashtag pants up, don't loot on it. It is coming down to the wire of getting it up before the Wilson announcement. 29 funders have ponied up $3,081 to put up this slab of ignorance. Because, see, and I don't have to explain this now, do I? What the pants up thing means? It's a direct reference to how them people don't know how to wear pants. They wear them down around the bottoms of their buttocks. I actually learned the term for this once upon a time, and I can't remember it right now. It is it's a deliberate display of powerlessness. Yeah. Pants up, don't loot. So does that mean the Klan won't shoot you if you are wearing your pants in a fashion that the Klan deems appropriate? I mean, my God, if you look at some of those pictures from back during the Mississippi burning days, you'll notice that the good, God-fearing, Bible-believing, upstanding members of the Ku Klux Klan and the conservative, concerned citizens' white councils were wearing their pants back then up around their nipples. And their neckties were about 6 inches long, which is a whole lot longer than, well, you get the idea. So we got that going on. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Hey, Bob, did you hear that the Klan has started a diversity program? I don't know if I can cope with that. Meanwhile, while we're still in the Ferguson, Missouri area, another story breaking via the Huffington Post. Oh, dear. Texas Betsy with a note. You should have seen how Lucas's pants sagged all through eighth grade. Betsy says, but he's paler than I am, so it's okay. Well, Betsy? I mean, vis-a-vis the Klan, Betsy? Really? He could be so pale as to be translucent. Klan's still going to hate him because, you know, y'all ain't white and Christian. Just saying. The Huffington Post with a report. Headline, Ferguson Correctional Officer Jairus Hayden raped pregnant woman lawsuit alleges. A correctional officer in Ferguson, this story by Sebastian Murdoch at Huffington Post, a correctional officer in Ferguson, Missouri, is accused of raping a pregnant woman who was in his custody. Jairus Hayden, 29, was arrested last Wednesday on suspicion of having sex with a prisoner, permitting escape and corruption, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported. He's been released on $10,000 bail. I understand, Betsy. Betsy says, but he had stopped wearing a yarmulke in public by then. Yeah, I don't know. I think the last name's going to still be a little bit of a giveaway, Betsy. Copy of the lawsuit obtained by the Huffington Post claims that the victim, who is being identified by the initials JW, was arrested in October of last year after being pulled over for an expired license plate and charged with giving a false name. She says she was raped by Hayden, who allegedly made countless sexual advances to her before the act. And Jairus Hayden apparently is a real smooth operator. That's sarcasm, because in the suit papers it says that he would tell the victim, "You smell good," when he was booking her into the jail there at Ferguson, Missouri. She was pregnant at the time. By the way, after she posted bail and he took her out of her cell, he said, according to the suit papers again, You're the type of girl that can get me in trouble. And that's about the time that he led her down to the boiler room of the city of Ferguson jail, dropped his pants and said, "Oh, really, do we have to do this part? No. Too much trigger." And somehow or another, she managed to get a sample of pubic hair, which came back matched to Jairus Hayden. Oh, dear God. And that's just the beginning. Oh, okay, you had to ask, Marty. Answer the burning question, Bob. Is this officer black or white? This man is, this man's African American, black, of color, whatever phrase we prefer to use. He's a black man. And I'm wondering, within a structure of institutional corruption such as apparently exists in Ferguson, Missouri, what that has to do with anything. But I guess some folks want to know, to the same extent that I wondered this morning as the news was being announced. I wondered about the fact that a physician had finally died of Ebola in the United States. News having come out that the man had come from treating patients in Sierra Leone, had been gravely ill when he was taken to the medical center in Nebraska, where other people have been taken and survived. It was announced this morning. It had been announced all weekend that he was in dire circumstances, and this morning it was announced that he had died. And then I thought to myself, well, I'll be dipped. I guess doctors who have treated Ebola and are then subsequently treated in the United States, well, they sometimes die of it too. And then they showed his picture. So not only is the individual the first physician, he is the first black physician. Steve with a note, he says, I'd love to see the KKK's bank accounts emptied out and an anonymous large donation made to the United Negro College Fund. See the movie Sneakers. Sounds nice. And, yes, Marty writing back, as I feared. It's not an as I feared situation. We're talking about the behavior of people in a position of authority over people who have no, over people in a position of profound vulnerability. Whether it be an 18-year-old young man being hailed for walking on the public street, or a woman who is brought in for giving a false name. These are power dynamics, not race dynamics. Although, then you can make the argument that in terms of victim dynamics, sure, race probably does have a role to play. Yep. I mentioned CNN, and, Thanks, y'all. I don't know what happened to the stream there. It just sort of burped. Hopefully it won't happen again. Just a sec. I mentioned CNN a couple of minutes ago, I sat down last night to, through the miracle of the internet, to watch Anthony Bourdain's program on that network. And they did the rerun, if you were watching. They reran last week's episode featuring the the drug epidemic in a small Massachusetts town. And then followed up on what turned out to be not your typical story of vacationing in Jamaica. No, no, we don't have that much snow here. Did a snowbank collapse on Bob's studio? No. Just flurries so far and brutal cold. So anyway, the Jamaica episode was quite interesting. It was about resort development in places off the beaten path in Jamaica, and local responses to it of people not wanting to have their ways of life interrupted and having their coastline gentrified. It was fascinating all the way around. That's not what grabbed me, though. It was an ad. I'm suggesting that CNN change its name to the Anything for a Buck Network, because really, not kidding, shortly before the airing of the new episode, the Jamaica episode, and during the tail end of the heroin addiction, pill addiction episode from Massachusetts, an ad ran that made me go, what? Because it was an ad for Kazakhstan. Yes, that Kazakhstan. Central Asian Republic, former Soviet Republic. Right. And I kind of said, what? But it really was. And I went to find it. I did not find it on YouTube. But it said things like, what if a country had open invitations for immigration regardless of age? What if a return on $100,000 investment could net you $500,000? Blah, 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 blah. And of course, Kazakhstan is no small potatoes geographically. Most people don't realize it because most people don't spend much time at all thinking about it. But Kazakhstan is the size of the entirety of Western Europe. Yeah. And cold. And it is the ninth largest nation on Earth, and I think the largest entirely landlocked nation. Okay, those are interesting geographical facts that maybe you can win a beer with in a bar some evening. But it's the fact that Kazakhstan has has a troubled human rights problem. Among other things, according to the World Report on Human Rights for this year by Human Rights Watch, well, Human Rights Watch writes, Kazakhstan's poor human rights record continued to deteriorate in 2013, with authorities cracking down on free speech and dissent through misuse of overly broad laws. Authorities maintain strict controls on freedom of assembly and religion. Despite flawed trials, courts upheld the prison sentences of people convicted in the aftermath of violent clashes in December 2011 between police and people in the western oil town of Zanozen. Torture remains common in places of detention, even as authorities in July adopted a law on a national preventive mechanism on torture. The government continues to work on overhauling its criminal legislation, but based on a September draft of the criminal code, some amendments, if adopted, would further restrict freedom of speech, assembly, religion, and association. Yeah. And then the report continues to tell the story of Vadim Kuramshin, who was sentenced to 12 years imprisonment on extortion charges after a trial that was, at best, a sham. This is because he has advocated openly for good government. Then there's Rota Tulateva. She's serving a 5-year prison sentence reduced from 7 years on charges that she organized mass riots in connection with the Zanozen violence. Prosecutors have refused to investigate her claims that she was tortured while in custody. Then there's Vladimir Kozlov, 7.5-year prison sentence, and on charges of inciting social discord. And he is being denied appropriate medical care while in prison. Then there's Zinaida Mukhortova. Zinaida Mukhortova is a lawyer. And she alleged in 2009 that a member of the ruling party in parliament was monkeying around inside a civil case that she was involved in. Since she was a lawyer, instead of just hooking her up to the battery cables, they detained her and put her in a psychiatric hospital. Yeah. How about Mukhtar Ablyazov, who was detained in France? Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan are all trying to extradite him on charges that include embezzlement, among other things. Yeah. And groups like Human Rights Watch are amplifying concerns by other groups that if he's returned to any of these countries, he would be at serious risk of being tortured and would not have any chance at all of a fair trial. Meanwhile, and this is, when I read this earlier, I went, what? His wife and child were illegally deported, Human Rights Watch says, to Kazakhstan from Italy in May. United Nations experts said the move resembled an extraordinary rendition. You remember extraordinary rendition, right? Sure. Ever since 2012, Kazakhstan has been involved in what's described as a crackdown on independent and opposition media. Newspapers have been banned. Broadcast outlets have been forbidden to broadcast. In 2013, several newspapers, including Pravda Kazakhstana and Tribuna, were suspended for 3 months on technical grounds. The Zhekazgan youth newspaper has been ordered to close. And the country is still ruled by the same guy that was ruling it, if I understand correctly, when the Soviet Union fell apart. Democracy! Now, this was all available to me simply for the cost of the precious finite time of my existence that it required to type in the words Kazakhstan, human, and rights into a search engine, any search engine. Apparently, no one at the advertising marketing department of CNN has access to a search engine, or maybe they can't type. Maybe they just have to peck the letters with their little noses, and something, you know, it's really hard to see the letters when you're doing that. There are moments in existence when binocular vision, such as we humans have, can be less than helpful. Apparently, when you have to peck out search terms with your nose on a keyboard in the marketing department of CNN, is one of them. So I just had to work in that nomination for CNN for taking my, but then again, why is anybody surprised? Why was I surprised? Why was I surprised? Because after all, even in the face of a mounting horror of evidence, CNN has for long and long and long gladly accepted money from the American Clean Coal Energy Coalition for Freedom in America or some such idiotic Orwellian organization. They've run clean coal ads till hell wouldn't hold them. That's the same clean coal that poisons people every day of every year. Ron and Raleigh write in Kazakhstan, huh? Kazakhstan, the world's largest landlocked country, sort of the Roach Motel of countries. Tourists go in, but they never leave. Nice. So, no small number of Moran availabilities this evening. While we're at it, let's run up, while we're at it, by at it I mean in search of Morans, let's run up to Massachusetts. This is a dandy. The Boston Globe has reported that a pair of individuals, and God, don't they look like they were just made for each other, a pair of individuals decided to assault and batter a member of the MBTA. That's either Massachusetts Bay Area Transit Authority or Metro Boston Transit Authority. The two individuals, Robert G. Snyder, aged 50, and Shayla Witz, aged 28. I'm not sure, but I think Shayla's middle name is Loster. Shayla Loster Witz? No, sorry. They're homeless people. And more than that, they are apparently racist homeless people. They were in the Orange Line station when they attacked an MBTA employee and were screaming the usual, described as racial epithets, you know what that epithet is. When they repeatedly punched the MBTA employee in the face and tore out his hair. The charges are as follows: aggravated assault and battery on a public employee, battery and bodily injury to intimidate because of race, and disorderly conduct. Mr. Robert G. Snyder, age 50, has a rap sheet and has apparently been convicted of assault 12 different times. Prostitution charges are pending for 28-year-old Ms. Witt. Witts. They shared a tender kiss as they were led into the courtroom for their arraignment. They were admitted to bail. This incident apparently happened last Monday. They were admitted to bail, $10,000 for cash bail for Snyder, $5,000 for Ms. Witts. But they're not getting out on bail because what they did also constitutes a probation violation. According to the police papers and the court records and the Boston Globe, an inspector was working at the southbound platform at Downtown Crossing around 3:30 a.m. Sunday and was in the process of closing the station when he began escorting an intoxicated man and woman from the station. The man, later identified as Snyder, allegedly sucker-punched the T employee and then grabbed him in a headlock. While the employee was unable to defend himself, Witts allegedly began punching him too, and also began pulling out his hair. Police wrote that when they arrived, there was a blood trail about 30 feet long, interspersed with hair extensions ripped from the victim's head. They were read their rights in accordance with the law, at which point Snyder and Witts apparently felt like sharing. And Snyder said, smiling, they note, he was smiling when he spoke. I punched him a few times. And then his girlfriend, Ms. Witts, chimed in and said it all started when some black girl with attitude told them to leave the station because the station was closing at the end of the night owl service. Ms. Witts then said she stated Snyder struck the employee in relation, and then referred to the three individuals as the subject racial epithet. Not racial epithet, racist epithet. Please, Boston Globe. Here's the interesting thing. 50-year-old Mr. Snyder managed to escape capture until he was caught up with at Mass General Hospital about 2 hours later. Pathetic. Just pathetic. Like I said, being as how More and Mondays come after weekends, there's never a want for subject matter. You may recall we talked a little bit this past week about how Senator Ted Shut the Government Down Cruz has declared war on net neutrality, having declared that it is Obamacare for the Internet, whatever that may possibly mean. Does that mean with net neutrality, more people would get the Internet? Because with Obamacare, more people have gotten health care. No, I don't think that's what Senator Ted was meaning. So, since we were talking about CNN a moment or two ago, CNN's Candy Crowley decided to take up the issue on Sunday, and they invited Senator Al Franken on to discuss the issue. That's where we pick up the audio.
So let's go back to what net neutrality is. All content is treated neutrally.
Now let's understand here, yes, Senator Franken did once upon a time have a career as a comedian and a comic writer. He has, since entering the Senate of the United States, however, managed to restrain himself fairly well from any urges he may have felt to engage that famous comic wit. I don't think he probably has had a greater challenge, however, to restraining himself than here. This, and you can almost hear it in his voice, the hesitations, the deliberate nature, right?
Net neutrality is all content is treated neutrally. It travels essentially at the same speed, if you will, so that CNN's website, blog from a blogger in Duluth, Minnesota, travels at the same speed. The New York Times travels, their website travels at the same speed. That's the way it's been from the beginning, and we want to keep it that way.
If Netflix wants you not to have a little circle in your house when you're looking at Netflix, it could pay more and get on a...
Notice the use of the highly technical language by ace for-profit media reporter Candy Crowley. If Netflix doesn't want the little circle in your house, I'm surprised there's no goddamn Calliope music playing.
The fast lane, as it were.
Yeah, and let me tell you why this is a terrible, terrible, terrible idea to have a fast lane. I'll give you an example with YouTube. Before YouTube, there was this thing called Google Video that Google had, and it wasn't very good. The guys who started YouTube were three guys over a pizzeria in San Mateo, California. It created a superior product, YouTube, and it traveled at the same speed as Google Video, and people liked YouTube better. So YouTube won because it was better. And a few years later, Google bought YouTube for $1.65 billion.
Again. Notice how Al Franken is, in the course of explaining it to ace crack media, for-profit media reporter Candy Crowley, speaking very slowly so that ace crackpot for-profit media reporter Candy Crowley might possibly, maybe, sorta, kinda, actually comprehend the points being delivered.
Okay, so this was three guys above a pizzeria. Facebook was started in a dorm room at a college. That's the innovation that we have seen on the internet since the very beginning. It's always been, net neutrality has always been there.
So what about the argument that this now takes the internet providers, the Comcast, the AT&T, and gives them no real reason to innovate, that they will hold back on expanding the band?
Well, Candy, they're not exactly innovating in the first place. But let's see what Al says.
That's
what about
baloney.
That argument?
That's baloney. They want... they. They've been doing this all along. They've been doing this since the beginning of the Internet. This isn't going to stop. This, all this stops them from doing is make a whole bunch of extra money. But this is not going to stop them from wiring the country.
I want to, this has obviously entered the political realm. We saw the president weighing in on it this past week. I wanted to read you something from an op-ed that Senator Ted Cruz wrote about the issue.
Okay. Al, you're from Minnesota. Surely to God you've got a hockey puck. You should probably carry one.
Net neutrality is Obamacare for the Internet. It would put the government in charge of determining Internet prices, terms of service, and what types of products and services can be delivered, leading to fewer choices, fewer opportunities, and higher prices. Government-regulated utilities invariably destroy innovation and freedom.
Oh, boy. This ought to be fun. Well, looks like that curve hung up over the plate, baseball fans.
Your reaction?
He has it completely wrong. He just doesn't understand what this issue is. We've had net neutrality the entire history of the Internet. So when he says this is the Obamacare, Obamacare was a government program that fixed something, that changed things. This is about reclassifying something so it stays the same. This would keep things exactly the same that they've been. And the pricing happens by the value of something.
That makes way too much sense. And, of course, Al Franken is being charitable, to say the least, when he says that Ted Cruz doesn't understand. I suspect Ted Cruz might actually understand. However, the problem is Ted Cruz, and I don't want to put too fine a point on this, Ted Cruz is a liar, okay? He's a professional liar. He's a pathological liar. If you were in an enclosed space with no windows and you asked Ted Cruz what color the sky is, whatever answer he gave, you would be well suited to go outside and check because, as we say here in the Hills and Hollers, the truth ain't in him. It just isn't. This is the guy who shut the government down over lies. So there's that. And, you know, frankly, a hell of a lot more. But we should probably stop for the end of the More and Monday filibobster, and let me invite you to participate in the program. A reminder, this evening is a have a show on me More and Monday, courtesy of Roger, who is encouraging people not to rest upon their laurels or lick their wounds after this electoral defeat, but rather to get busy and fix the problem that attaches to particularly voters in Texas whose only ID is a Veterans Administration photo ID, which is not acceptable to the powers that be as particular proof or sufficient proof of identity for voting purposes. Thank you again very much, Roger. And, of course, you too can contribute and help us keep all of this going if you are so inclined. Jan and Jerry jumped out there this evening and got us a nice start well into tomorrow. And with the help that we recently received from our buddy Irish Dave, one could say that we are started on Wednesday, which is great, which is awesome. Let's keep that ball rolling. Let's keep that momentum up there. Because anytime I've learned this the hard way, anytime that we get out in front, people tend to go, "Oh, okay, well they're out front. That means, why didn't he, maybe when the mic's not hot anymore. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com, and you are free to jump in and help us keep all of this going. I thought of the very same thing, Steve. Steve with an email following the Al Franken clip. Subject line, thank you, Senator Ted Stevens.
The Internet is not something you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
In the next, next hour, which we're already into, by the way, of More in Monday, I suppose we should address the issue of the Keystone XL pipeline. Because there's some morality involved there. Note coming in from Tim from L.A., subject line, on the bus. Isn't a racial attack on a train a federal offense? Trains are federal jurisdiction, right? Unless it's interstate, or does it matter if federal could not then the FBI file charges of a federal hate crime? Just wondering. Well, this all happens. This is the train line that runs through the Metro Boston area. And so, no, I don't know. U.S. Attorney for that district of Massachusetts would be perfectly well within his or her rights in examining that issue, but it sounds like no. Because one of the crimes charged is that the attack was racially motivated. I think at some point Ms. Witz said, yeah, he spent 17 years in the pen, and he don't take no lip from no magic word. Right. So let's take a wee bit of a break. I will remind you of the numbers now. If you wish to reach the program, you can jump in by connecting 304-663-4676. That's 304-663-HORN, H-O-R-N. That's the Gizmo line. If you want to use the other line, that's open too. 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. And, of course, Skype to Skype always works quite well. And that is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn. So let's take a break, and we will come back to your comments or my filibobster. It is entirely a matter of your own choosing. Jump right in. The conversation, as they say, is fine. Listener-supported conversation radio is what this is. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. By the quarter-inch cut of your hair, You know, in my world, there's never a bad time for Natalie Merchant. 10,000 Maniacs. 14 minutes past the hour, and looks like I'll be filibobstering a bit. And that's okay, because there's plenty to filibobster over. Here's, oh God. Story comes from WGHP television. WGHP is a TV station in North Carolina. And, of course, this... Thank God. It's the story of a little boy. A little boy, 13 years old. 13-year-olds are little boys. Thirteen-year-olds are indeed little boys, and Nathan Andrew Clark was at the Comfort Suites Hotel in the Raleigh area. He was participating in the Capital Area Soccer League tournament. It was 11 o'clock at night. And a woman who was in the room with him, according to WGHP, called 911 and said, "I don't know what has happened to him. He's bleeding profusely from a bump on the back of his head. I don't know if he hit his head or something." And family members were trying to resuscitate him, but they weren't having any luck. And by the time the paramedics arrived, they said, "Well, that's because he's dead." Randall Lewis Vader, V-A-T-E-R, was in a nearby room, as the report puts it, and he had guns with him. And it turns out that Randall Lewis Vader, freedom protector, had accidentally discharged his weapon, at which point the round traveled through the wall of the hotel and into young Nathan Andrew Clark's room, where the bullet ended its journey inside his brain. As the report notes, Vader has a rap sheet. He's been in prison on everything from violating a restraining order to communicating threats to hit and run. Not threats to hit and run, but communicating threats, "I'm gonna kill you," to hit and run. He had been in police custody as of October 25th, even. He was charged with involuntary manslaughter and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. I'm surprised North Carolina hasn't gotten around to restoring all gun rights to all convicted felons yet. You know, a pistol round can exit the muzzle at something in excess of 1,000 feet per second, and they go through walls real well. It's interesting that in the report, if you read it, you see it, the woman doesn't report hearing a bang or a pow. Just the boy starts bleeding from his head. But that's okay, because we have to let the Vaders of the world have their illegal firearms. Because if we did a bunch of background checks and registered firearms and made double secret probation sure that they weren't getting in the hands of convicted felons, well, that would just be punishing law-abiding citizens who merely need a firearm so that they can feel safe when they go down to the Wiggling Pig for a jug of milk and a loaf of bread. Wolverines! Dear God. And there's a companion story with that, but let's go to the phones instead. Hey, welcome to the program.
Now I'm too sad to talk, Bob.
Sorry, Diane.
That's all right. How old was the young man?
He was 13.
Yeah, we're not safe from these people. So sorry. Anyway, how are you tonight, besides this rain of horrible news?
I've gotten through an hour and 20 minutes of the program. I consider that a bonus. The news is seldom sunny, and apparently the weather around here isn't either. So, to be quite candid, Diane, I'm a little freaked out because the next two nights we're going to be down in the low teens, and here at the mansion, when we get down in the low teens, it's like not having walls.
Yeah, yeah. You're using space heaters. And
yeah. Little portable propane affairs and furnace died.
Yeah, no. And how's your roof?
The roof is good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's frigid here. I usually go out for a walk on any given day, just layer up, but it's just frigid. It's just too cold. And it's too much of a shock because a few days ago it was 70 here.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Well, and listening to you, and by the way, I hope you are able to keep warm without too much trouble.
Well, if last winter is any indication, I will I'll put on about 4 soft layers and get under 2 sleeping bags and be okay.
Uh-huh. Oh. Okay. Well, I don't have any issues with heat where I am. I mean, in keeping the house heated, but we did have an ice storm about 5 years ago, and it was severe, and I was without electricity for a week and moved in with a friend. But that experience taught me to have, backup. You know, I have a little solar panel and a generator. It can fire up. And I have a one of those heaters that takes kerosene, you know, and radiates heat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Yes, I'm well familiar with those.
Yeah. And, I mean, I don't use that except if we have another ice storm, I'm just not going to be in the same position I was in last time. And fortunately, my house never got below 40. It kept dropping day by day. I think the last day it was 38 degrees upstairs in my house. I don't know, the cats in the basement, I guess they were warm enough. But I would come in every day to check the thermostat because, you know, you have to keep your water pipes dripping, you know, all that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But I wasn't too badly off, but, boy, afterwards I went to the Chinese grocery store here and got 3 of those little burners that you just pour little, you know, gas into and flick them on, and you have 2 little burners. You can have coffee, and I don't know if you've ever seen such a thing, but they sell them at the Chinese grocer here. And so you can, there's just a little can you insert into the apparatus and flick something on and you get a flame. So that's all I needed. I just needed a flame.
Right, yeah.
To get my coffee in the morning. But a friend took pity on me and I was fine. I wanted to comment on what I heard you report tonight, Bob, and what I heard come through was a juxtaposition of all those hooded creeps in Missouri. I didn't even know the Ku Klux Klan was still around. I don't know where I've been, but I'm just amazed that they have a blatant presence now on the internet and elsewhere. I'm amazed. And so there was that, and then you report in Massachusetts on homeless people behaving similarly. And the juxtaposition was just weird. You know, it's like, I don't know, can't the white people behave themselves? You know, I mean,
I chuckle, but, you know, there is that eternal question, you know, what's the matter with white people?
Yeah, I'm wondering. I don't understand. I really don't. And like I said, I don't know where I've been, but it's surprising me that the Klan is exerting a presence in Missouri. Maybe Carol on the ground has some further insights into that. I mean, I know they were part of the Confederacy.
Well, they were and they weren't. I mean, remember, Missouri was one of those border states that was neither, it wasn't for them or against them. Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, West Virginia, and I don't remember what Kansas' status was.
Well, we were bleeding Kansas, what I remember of our history, and I don't study it that much, but you know, the people from Missouri would come in because Kansas was, a lot of people in Kansas were fighting for freedom for the slaves, and people from Missouri, a lot of them came in and shot people at our polls, even back then, or especially back then, I should say. So there's quite a history with bleeding Kansas and marauders from Missouri coming in and causing a lot of trouble. So that's why I thought they were whether or not they were technically in the Confederacy, they caused a lot of trouble around that issue, and for Kansans especially. So.
Well, the idea that the one thing that's really going to make a difference in this situation is for some jackass from Tennessee to put up a billboard that says pants up, don't loot.
Hands up, don't loot. Funny. From Tennessee.
Yes.
And he has to insert himself, he and his fellow whatever you want to call them, they have to insert themselves into a situation in Missouri.
Right.
On a billboard.
Right. Because, you know, the rights of white people are being trampled.
Yeah. We're so victimized. It's just amazing. I had this sense, I'm sure I'm not the only one, that something's been, like, there's been a scab on something in the last few years. It's just been ripped off the nation.
I think you're spot on there, because this nation is vibrating from all of the manifestations of inequality and injustice that are everywhere to be seen. I just got a note in from Sergi in Texas, and Sergi says, "Sure as the grass is green, the sky is blue, water's wet, and Ursine mammals void their digestive system waste products in sylvan environments, the KKK is alive and well. Down here in Texas, Stan, a couple of weeks ago, in the Dallas sprawl burb of Rockwell, the KKK and neo-Nazis had a big rally, and back in 2009 in Marshall, the KKK attacked black churches."
Oh, no!
It's all over the country.
When did this pop up that they were so brazenly out in the street again and not just in their basements reading material or whatever they did? I mean, I don't remember them being out on the streets before.
Oh, gosh, yes. And remember, Ronald Reagan kicked off one of his two presidential campaigns in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah, sure. But does it seem to you that organization, I mean, I know the Southern Poverty Law Center has been on groups like that and reporting on them and keeping track of them.
And they have broken them a couple of times. But the same, but the problem there, and it lies within our legal structure, Diane, is that you can break one organization and another one just, it's a hydra, if you will. Look at, granted, not the same topic, but they're close enough for government work. Look at Operation Rescue. Now, our dear friend Beth in Dallas could probably spend the remainder of the program telling you everything you ever wanted to know or didn't about Operation Rescue. This is the horror show anti-abortion group that was led by Randall Terry. Well, Randall Terry got busted all the way down to the ground, and Operation Rescue was bankrupted to one degree or another. And what did he do? Well, he went off and founded Jesus Loves Fetuses or something like that. And so that's the way this stuff operates. As long as there's no connection, you know, the Klan got busted. Well, that's okay. There can be a new Klan. And if that Klan gets busted, they'll bring up another one. And you know why? Because freedom. See,
freedom.
We have this misguided notion in the United States that somehow we protect the freedom of everybody by protecting the freedom of people who are at heart homicidal maniacs.
That word has almost no meaning to me anymore because it's just so all over the place.
Freedom or homicidal maniac?
But yeah. It's a word used by homicidal maniacs, but freedom, I mean, what? Freedom, it just hardly has any meaning to me. At least when I hear it for the first time from someone, unless the context is just crystal clear, just leery of the word. Freedom.
Well, when it's being voiced by right wingers, it is, I would say, advisable to grab your wallet or check your purse. Because
that is what I use.
Yeah, freedom to a right winger only means the freedom to engage in some sort of economic oppression or economic skullduggery or economic leisure domain. And then there's that other element of American society that says that freedom is the freedom to choose from 29 different breakfast cereals, as Dr. John has frequently pointed out. But there is next to no analysis or consideration in this country of what actual real freedom really means.
That's my view. Because sometimes in the field I'm in, I'm using it in the context of freedom to provide a benefit to someone else. And I realize that I'm not really hearing that too often.
No, and of course we hear that phrase also in the realm of your endeavor. We hear about academic freedom.
Oh, yeah.
But
that means something to me, by the way.
Well, I have no doubt that it does.
It
it means something closer to actual freedom because academic freedom is attached to freedom of conscience.
Right, and truth telling.
Right, which is the real freedom. You know, freedom is not defined by whether or not you have enough money to upgrade from, say, from a Mercedes to a Maybach. That's a vacuous sort of freedom. But the freedom to speak one's mind intelligently and candidly and within the realm of one's best understanding, that's serious stuff. And so, but even that is to one degree or another constrained, and all one need do is consider, say, Ward Churchill.
Oh yeah, Colorado.
Or the professor who was damn near burned at the stake in Florida for asking students, and it was a thought exercise. And I know you know what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Write the name Jesus on a piece of paper and put it on the floor and step on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now there was nothing about it that said anyone actually had to do that. But for merely mentioning it, a firestorm erupted inside Florida.
Well, I remember that. Yeah,
sure. And this kind of stuff happens constantly, it seems.
Yeah. Well, Ward Churchill, I mean, when all that happened, I thought, you know, he's going to be exonerated, you know, very soon in history. I mean, remember, he was saying stuff that people now say openly.
What got him was the chickens have come home to roost.
Well, really, isn't that eye-opening? I mean, a lot of us were thinking that almost immediately, and that's been said in different ways since.
But you know what? I remember, he's cranky, and I don't pay much attention to him, and he's kind of a freak. But I remember when Republicans booed Ron Paul for saying same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, the Republicans booed him?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well.
They booed him when
he said someone should die in a hospital waiting room.
Exactly. Actually, he didn't say it. He said, what do you want to do? Let them die in the corridor. And they clapped and they cheered and they flung poo, you know, and behaved like the monkeys they are. That's probably being too rough on the monkeys, but no, yeah. Ron Paul used a fancier term and therefore was not completely excoriated because I guess you can talk about the chickens coming home to roost as long as you call it blowback.
Oh, well, that's what the scholar in California, he wrote a book called Blowback, that political scientist, and I tried to mention him before to you, but I blanked on his name both times. But he's written on blowback. He's the one who wrote on empire, and he was saying quite clearly, and he was doing interviews on C-SPAN, you know, book notes or whatever it was called back then, he was saying what you have also said, that we can either have democracy or empire, but not both.
Right. There are no democratic empires.
No.
Because empires are founded on oppressive conduct.
Yeah.
And exploitation.
Yeah.
Ah, Chalmers Johnson.
Chalmers Johnson, that's him.
Yes,
thank you, Bob.
No.
How could I forget him?
No, thank Walking Steve in the chat room.
Oh, thank you, Walking Steve?
Walking Steve.
Oh, Walking Steve. Thank you, Walking Steve. Exactly. What a bright man he was.
And by the way, Carol cheered when you entered the conversation, and she pointed out racism is the new black, Diane. It's so in.
It's in. Ooh. That's probably right. How dangerous is that?
And by way of sort of expanding on the notion, this morning I read, and usually when these right-wing things show up in my email box, I go, nope, not this time. The Washington Examiner is a right-wing thing, and they are not to be too terribly associated with the idea of journalism. But I read this thing earlier today because it was so out of character, or maybe it was in character. But the reason it grabbed me is because it was a right-wing outfit who was saying straight up the end of coal, okay?
Oh.
That's the title of the story, the end of coal. And in a way, I kind of, you know, face-palmed because I went, I'll be damned, the elections are over, so now they're telling the truth. Because this would never have been published before November the 4th, because back before November the 4th, you know, that Obama's, he's a war on coal. And it's still in there. Let's see. The second and third paragraph of this story, just listen. The owner of a trucking business, and this is someone in Logan, West Virginia, a place with which I am familiar, the owner of a trucking business says his workforce has dwindled from 37 to 4. A mine safety officer says he's lucky he wasn't one of the more than 100 people who got laid off at his company, but even so, he accepts that he's going to have to leave town too or end up unemployed. Two security staffers who work for the Tennesseans company bicker about President Obama. It'll come back in about 3 or 4 years once we get this asshole out of office. It always does. But, and here's the interesting part, the owner of the trucking company looks at him and says, nope, not this time. And then, of course, the right-wing article goes into environmental regulations, blah, 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 blah. But they have not yet figured out that they don't. It's a little word. It's six letters. F-I-N-I-T-E. Finite. And these right-wingers who think that Barack Obama has a war on coal have not figured out that coal is a finite resource.
Well,
so it's not about regulations or the EPA or that Obama or Kenyan Muslim socialism or anything like that. It's about the fact that they've already gotten all the coal and they aren't making it anymore.
Well, there's two things that come to mind. Stupid people here, you know, overall, we're just not that bright anymore. I don't know if we ever were. And second, I just think because in their minds we have, quote, a black man in the White House, then everything becomes turned around, up for grabs. I don't know. It's a nightmare. It's really a nightmare to hear this.
Well, when you consider the impact that mercury has on the human brain, and I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
And you consider that we have been burning coal copiously in this country for about 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
What effect does the mercury from burning coal have on a human population over a transgenerational period of 150 years?
20 IQ points?
Sure, why not?
10, 15, 20? I mean, it's a...
Maybe it's not points. Maybe it's percentages. You know, if every generation gets dumbed down by 10% because
right.
of mercury,
yeah.
and it's bioaccumulative, and so generation A gets dumbed down by 10%, so that means generation 2 starts dumbed down by 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow?
Yep.
Because mercury transits the placental barrier.
Yeah, that's gruesome. And we know it. We have enough science to know this. This is known. Yeah.
Yeah. No. This is not some sort of secret wisdom you have to join the lodge to get.
Oh, I mean, there are people who just won't eat fish because of this.
And for good reason. For good reason.
Yeah, I don't eat fish. Not much.
The general rule of thumb is that you can eat riverine or freshwater fish about once a month before you start getting so stupid you wind up picking your teeth with your toenail clippings.
Silly species. Well, you know, along the lines of a paper coming out with news after the fact of the election. You know what happened in Kansas, and I can barely talk about it.
Yeah, you had such high hopes, didn't you?
Well, there seemed to be a glimmer of something might break free here. But Kansas could not get over its frickin' self. You know, Kansas could not get over itself. That's just my bottom line with this. Brownback, I remember talking with you, and you told me that the poll at the time we were talking was showing Davis, the running, his contender, 9 points behind or something. And I remember thinking and maybe even saying out loud to you, well, if it was close, it would be good news. In other words, I wasn't really believing that poll.
Right.
I just couldn't, I mean, just by virtue of living here, I would want to believe it. But, you know, the day after the election, I looked at the local news and people were saying that Davis didn't run a good campaign. Whatever. What kind of campaign would you have to run to beat Brownback, who's ruining this state?
No, see, I have no patience for the didn't. Okay, I do have some patience because there are people who truly ran abhorrent, abysmal campaigns.
And
that in turn resulted in people who might have come out to vote simply staying home. And when you combine crummy campaigns that don't get the vote out with a barrage of right-wing ads that just make you sick of the entire process, and then you combine that with the well-meaning people out there who say, well, there's not really a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, why bother? Hello, Governor Brownback.
Well, you know, along the lines of what you were saying about a newspaper coming out with a line, the end of coal, but after the fact of the election, I walk by a newspaper stand in the building in which I teach, and so there's all these, you know, newspapers behind glass lined up vertically, and I can just read the titles one by one, the headlines one by one, you know, Kansas City Star, Manhattan Mercury, Topeka Capital Journal, and all of them after the election, and I stopped to read the content, too, through the glass. All of them were saying that the economists working on the budget in Topeka were coming right after election, came out with worse projections about our budget deficit. And I read enough to be horrified because it was already bad. So that comes out, I mean, within a day or two after Brownback is reelected. And Brownback didn't win by much, if I'm remembering the information. I mean, I had to...
Yeah, but a miss is as good as a mile when it comes down to it. And what you've got now is Bleeding Budget Kansas.
Yeah, Bleeding Budget Kansas. But he In the story I read the day after the election, he was claiming a mandate to go on with his policies. And the day after, that's what he's saying in print. That's what they're quoting him as saying. And then a day or two after that, I'm looking at this newsstand. I'm looking at every paper of note coming out with these worst projections about our deficit. And, you know, I think almost all states have to balance their budgets. I'm not sure all 50 states do, but most of the states do have to balance their budget every year. So, I just don't know what's going to happen here. And also, but you see what I mean? I'm suspicious. It's announced after he wins that his budget is going to be first.
Sure. Yeah, because the first thing you think is, where were you last week?
Yeah.
It's not like
it's all ego, you know.
It's not like they just crunched the numbers the next day.
Exactly. And I read the content pretty carefully to see that they were revising their projections downwards. You know, I'm an economist. I know what that means. You know, you're right. They don't just, you know, I don't know what new information they would have
They didn't. And that's probably one of the underreported stories out of this cycle is the absolute abdication of any kind of civic or moral obligation on the part of a number of so-called journalism outfits. The one I think about most is the Des Moines Register. Now, the Des Moines Register could not print enough stories about Bruce Braley saying that, that for all intents and purposes, that Chuck Grassley was a dumbass farmer with pig poo between his toes. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what the story wound up being.
Oh.
When, in fact, what Bruce Braley said was, you know, listen, if the Republicans get the majority, you're going to wind up with a farmer in charge of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, I
remember
that's
that. That's a statement of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know,
argued on that basis, not.
And I think you're supposed to. You have to say at this point in time, you have to say after you mentioned that there was some other more artful way of putting it. But there wasn't.
Yeah.
He was talking to a bunch of trial lawyers, and we're talking about the trial lawyers meat and potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to plain Midwestern forthright, you know, no BS speech?
Yeah.
But no, like I said, by the time the Des Moines Register was done with it, he'd called him a no-account hick who didn't know Sunday from Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, all those papers in Kansas.
Uh-oh.
And every time I run across one of these stories, I always think back to, you know, the gray lady, the New York Times, that bastion of journalism integrity, who sat on the domestic spying story back in 2004, lest they be accused of trying to swing the election in favor of John Kerry.
Mm.
Oh, please.
Really?
Now, yeah, the biggest story.
Miller, I lost interest in
that. Well, and that's part of it. But the biggest story since the Pentagon Papers, the fact that the United States was actively spying on its own citizens, and the New York Times said, well, you know, we'll publish this after the election.
Yeah. Well, it sounds to me like the former owner of the Washington Post saying, you know, what was the decision? The United States can't stand another impeachment crisis.
Yeah, that was over Ronald Reagan and
Catherine
Graham. Yeah, was over Ronald Reagan and Iran-Contra.
Yeah.
When in fact,
they get to decide for us. Get to decide when we get our information.
Exactly. And two, the fact that we have a constitution that is specifically designed to deal with such crises.
Right. And give the press freedom of speech. You know, protects them, supposedly. Although I don't know what's going to happen with the New York reporter that Obama's Justice Department is going after. What's his name? Reisman? I can't remember his name, but I don't think
Reisman, I think, yeah.
I don't think that case is over. I don't understand the aggressiveness of President Obama's administration towards whistleblowers. I mean, maybe just on its face, it's evident, but I'm surprised. I mean, President Obama does not exert that much leadership, in my view. I mean, that's an understatement, really. He does not exert that much leadership. And then where is he leading in going after whistleblowers, in using the Alien and Sedition Act more than any other president before him? I mean, what's that about?
That's about empires behaving as empires behave.
Well, but I mean,
I don't mean to be facile when I say that, but
yeah.
You know, this is not some sort of Republican democracy. This is an empire, and with the rise of the national security state in 1948, everything changed.
Yeah.
Whether people realized it or not.
The act that created the CIA in 1946, right?
Yeah.
And of course, it existed in another form before.
Well, it was the OSS during the Second World War.
Yeah.
But by 1963, Harry Truman, who signed it into law, is saying we need to scrap the whole thing, and he says it, you know, publicly in an editorial, we need to scrap the whole thing and start all over because this was never what was intended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
Harry
we didn't.
Truman, well, he had some plain speaking moments, didn't he?
Well, yeah, he did, and I mean, you know, that. Harry's kind of a mixed bag, but you get the sense that at least you knew what you were getting with him.
Yeah. Yeah, he came out of the Pendergast machine is what my parents always told me. I've never checked that out. It's way before my time. But then, dropping the nuclear bomb on two Japanese cities, that's all I need to know about him. I mean, I would not count that as a great presidential act, or, you know, I have a lot of questions about that.
No, that's a mark of infamy, because it marked us as the only country in the world ever to use nuclear devices on another country.
Yeah.
And particularly civilians.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was that, right. But it was embedded in our history, right, given what the soldiers were doing with Gatling guns in the Philippines, remember? What Mark Twain wrote about.
Oh, sure.
I mean, so I see our culture as, just having these things embedded in it, and then under certain conditions, it just comes, you know, like breaking through the crust. And,
Well, I think you're right. You know, it's in our DNA in many ways. I mean, I'm one of those people who holds to the theory the United States would never have dropped an atomic device on Europe.
Yeah.
We would never have dropped an atomic bomb on white people, even if they were Nazi white people.
Right. Yeah.
Now, we might firebomb their cities, and we might actually do more damage with the firebombing than an atomic blast would have done, but we would not have, you know, because we certainly did a number on Dresden.
Yes. That's true. And I don't think we just keep moving ahead. I think that's part of this culture. We don't stop and have a reflexive self-examination. There's too much, you know, we move ahead, and there's too much glitter around us and moving objects. And I don't think the society goes through, I don't know, do you know of a time when we went through kind of a deep reflection on our actions? Is that
the only time that may even remotely have happened in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Yeah. It was Reconstruction.
And it didn't last because the government bailed out on Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of I meant to interject this, it's not that important, but, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center. I cannot remember the name of the gentleman who led that for years, and maybe he's still director, but he was one of those speakers that Kansas State brought in that lecture series I've told you about and mentioned before, this progressive lecture series that we have on campus. And the reason I'm mentioning that is when I'm sitting at the steering committee, I'm hearing about stuff that happened years ago that I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't know about otherwise. So the chair of the committee said that when Kansas State brought the gentleman from who heads up the Southern Poverty Law Center in, they didn't announce it, but they had that hall locked down with security, really. Lockdown's not the right word. They had undercover cops all over that auditorium when he came.
Do you mean Morris D's?
I think that is. Isn't he the longstanding
yes.
founder? Yeah. Yes. And the chair of the committee got to know him a bit, it seems, and she reports the way he's had to live is just constant vigilance, bodyguards and constant vigilance. And I don't know what year they brought him in to our university to speak in this lecture series that's it's overtly progressive. But they had police everywhere. So then one person on the committee said, because we're brainstorming about, you know, topics and speakers and at times, and he said, well, how about someone, right after I heard that, then someone from the English department, where, by the way, is where a lot of cultural critics are these days. I love being around them. He said, well, let's bring in someone to talk about the gun issue. And the rest of us were like, just, you know, our mouths were open, and I found the words to say, no, I don't think so. They're crazy, and they'll have guns. And I'm talking about who would show up in that night in
right.
the auditorium. But, you know, that's a shame. But I was surprised to find out that there'd been so many undercover security guards and police the night that he spoke. But it wasn't advertised as such. So just a little bit of bleeding Kansas here. Just a little bit of history.
I'll be honest, Diane. I'm amazed that lecture series is allowed to persist.
Oh, well, yeah, that's interesting. I just take it for granted. It's also connected to what's called, it's called the University for Man, but we call it the UFM. So it's not only connected to getting funding from the provost's office, but it's also connected to that University for Man. I remember University of Kent had something like that where you could go and take non-credit courses or teach non-credit courses, and it's kind of loose, you know, like someone might want to teach a certain type of Marxism, or that really should be taught on campus. But, I mean, someone could propose to teach a non-credit course like that, and you could sign up for very little money and take it. So it's also connected to that in town. But it was established around a very beloved political science professor out of the 1960s who did a lot of, I'm told, did a lot of social advocacy in town. And one person they brought in who's a real fan of this lecture series is a former CEO of, God, is it Shell or something? I mean, he's one of our graduates. So, and I didn't go to that lecture. I get enough business stuff where I am, you know, I don't, but the reason I'm mentioning that is that he's retired and he's a fan of the lecture series. And so it's kind of, maybe what you would not expect. It's not challenged. Maybe that'll change. I don't know.
Let me shift gears with you for just a second, Diane. And this is more of a cultural thing than a political thing. You've been there on campus for a number of years now, so you see the annual arrival of the freshmen, and you see them presumably, you know, some portion of their academic maturation and matriculation. How much of a campus student misbehavior, binge drinking, sort of thing do y'all have out there? If I dare ask.
No, it's okay. I try to stay away from it. And it happens on game weekends. And I don't really have a good feeling for it because I stay away from anything to do with football, and that's where it manifests a lot, around those kind of weekends. And then if I know there's a game in town, I just stay home. And when 60,000 people or whatever are in the new stadium, then I go out and walk in the park and shop. I just partition myself off from when it's likely to be crazy. But I'm sure it goes on. But I see the business schools, they're always kind of siloed from the rest of the university, which is why I am enjoying serving on this committee for the Progressive Lecture Series, because I'm better at cross-disciplinary stuff. I like to be around different people, but business schools are kind of siloed, and I only have MBAs and seniors, and business students are, I'm not saying they're perfect, but they're pretty much focused by the time I get them. They're interviewing, they're meeting with recruiters on campus, so I'm not seeing what you're talking about.
Well, I ask because this state is sort of rocked and shocked by an event that happened at my alma mater, West Virginia University, in the last week. An 18-year-old college freshman is dead. Shortly before he was found unconscious and non-responsive at a fraternity house called Kappa Sigma, he tweeted, "It's about to be a very eventful night, to say the least." And after being found unconscious and not breathing, he died 2 days later at the local, the university's medical center. And this is a horrifying situation. And apparently, according to some reports, it was as a result of challenge drinking.
You
insert gender-based epithet here. You ain't drinking enough.
Oh, I see.
And I saw some of this stuff when I was a student. Hell, I probably participated in it in a much milder version, sitting around playing quarter bounce and things like that until you fell out of your chair, or someone did. But this is, hopefully with a little bit of maturity comes a little bit of reflection, and one of the things that's most frightening for me is the fact that my alma mater, Diane, has a reputation that the administration tries very hard to downplay and discourage and get rid of, but we are a party school. And so here's a young man from upstate New York whose only goal was to go to West Virginia University and study business.
Oh, he's a business student, but a new one. They can't take business courses usually until they're junior year, Bob.
Well, right. I mean, that's my understanding. The process hasn't changed that
major,
much.
Maybe.
Yeah, he was a declared business management.
Okay.
I mean, they're just pathetic scenes out of this. Two dozen students crowded around his hospital bed as he lay dying, singing "Take Me Home, Country Roads." Just heartbroken. The fraternities and sororities canceled all activities voluntarily, and I think even more action was taken subsequently. And this is not to say it doesn't happen at other universities, because it certainly does.
It does.
The only thing, Texas Betsy informs me, for instance, that her son and all fraternity and sorority members attend a two-hour class every fall about signs of alcohol poisoning and overdose and so forth.
That's good.
Well, it is good. And most of these fraternities have gone to being dry, what are called dry chapters. No alcohol is allegedly allowed into the houses.
Mm.
But there, you know, there's this larger issue of booze and, oh God, I'm going to sound like an old fogey, that attends the college experience. And as someone who has college age children who are working on trying to get in, it scares me to death.
Yeah, I think in Manhattan our police chief has had the bright idea of, because I mean I have the police on speed dial, and if I'm out and I hear a real loud party near campus in the house, there's a law against it, and I just call the police. I don't even have to leave my name, and they break it up. But they've got cops on bikes here now, and I think that's a step in the right direction, you know, because a lot of this could happen when there's a loud party, loud music, a lot of kids in one place, and if the cops are on a bike, you know, we have a law that they can't disturb the peace. And so that allows them to get off their bikes and go in. But, you know, I guess it's everywhere because I have 10 years experience. Every summer I teach at Dartmouth College to senior managers, and they're in a two-year graduate program. And so all of us, we stay in the same dorm, and it kind of we leave our windows open because it's sort of mountain air and all that, but the fraternity houses are in a row behind our dorm, and we're there on the weekend and teaching on the week. In the week, those of us, they fly in, and our students are in the same dorm. I mean, these are 50-year-old people with major responsibilities.
Right.
It's really kind of a hoot to be, you know, in the TV room with
them on
Saturday.
Please tell me they're not drinking.
Night.
Please tell me the 50-year-old middle managers are not drinking upside-down margarita shooters.
Oh, no.
Okay,
no.
Thank you.
Oh, no. I mean, no. They're in fact, always, you know, if they have any free time, these are busy people. These are like vice presidents of Samsung and directors of finance. And, I mean, and not that those people wouldn't drink per se, but what I observe about them is if they have any free time, they're checking in with their family or they're checking in with their staff back at the office. And I put them to work on the weekends. I mean, I've been sitting in the TV room in the dorm with them before when they're working on the cases they're going to have to present on Monday morning. So we're watching some DVD, and they're showing me their PowerPoint slides. They're working around the clock. But the point I wanted to make is all of us are hearing the partying from Fraternity Row all night long. And then in the morning, if I take a walk around the dorm, you know, I just see beer cans all over the place before they get around to picking them up. This is Dartmouth. I mean, these are not, you know, these are not kids who can't afford beer. And that's where Animal House was filmed, by the way.
I thought it was filmed out in the Great Northwest somewhere.
No, it's filmed at Dartmouth. And, I mean, I think they're kind of proud of it, maybe. I don't know. But I think this drinking thing, although I try to stay away from it, I think it is there, and we only know about it if there is a crisis, because otherwise they're sleeping it off Sunday morning. And, you know, I can only hope that the universities have ways to intervene, such as the training that Beth was talking about and counselors that could go to. But I don't know. Is Ferg thinking of going to
it's my alma mater, and I've told my children that there's a lot of places they might go to college, and WVU is one place that I really don't want them going.
Yeah. Well, you know, University of Colorado Boulder, that's known as a party school.
Sure.
And
from a larger perspective, I would prefer, if it's at all humanly possible, that they attend a small liberal arts college, because I have this turn of mind that says it's hard to learn in a lecture hall classroom with 350 students being taught by a hungover graduate assistant.
God. Oh, no, no, I agree with you. One thing I negotiated in my career is small class sizes. I don't want anything to do with that. I started out teaching lecture, you know, economics in a lecture hall at UMKC. It was fine. It was okay, but these kids need to be in groups. They need to be interacting with other students.
Well, and you know, one of the things that drives me crazy about the so-called Greek system is that, at least, because I know next to nothing about sororities, you know, for obvious reasons, but the fraternities were founded as rather elitist little debating societies. By well-heeled people. You know, my fraternity was founded by six sons of privilege, some from the South, some from the North, in 1848. And they were, you know, they were literally getting together to work on their Latin homework or their Greek. Probably their Greek. And, you know, some of them were involved in some sort of divinity study. And then, of course, capitalism kicks in and, you know, it became a business. I mean, the internationals or nationals of these fraternities are huge, multi-million-dollar operations with tremendous endowments.
Wow. Wow. Well, they should have, you know what, they should have someone, and maybe they do. They should have past graduates on the ground helping to direct the next generation. That would be a good model, right?
Well,
you know, like adults in the room and people they might look up to having something to do with their
back in the day, a fraternity would have what was called a house mother.
Oh yeah, yeah. I met one here. They might still have that.
Yeah, I think
here.
That's largely. I think mostly that went the way of the dodo.
Did it? About 10 years ago, I met someone at a bank who was working at a bank, but she had been a house mother. So who knows? That could have been 20 years ago, actually. You know, when she was a house mother, could have been by this time, long, long time ago. You don't think it's operating at all that way anymore?
Well, I don't know, but I'm guessing probably not, given the nature of the. But it's deeply disturbing here, and you know, there's well no I mean there's a I mean but you know, the rape culture issues, the fit, you know, the fit we talked about it last week, the fit that Rush Limbaugh threw because he thinks that that romance is dead at Ohio State University because they promulgated a consent policy.
Yeah, I don't know why he thinks he has to comment on stuff like that. I really don't. I mean, just the idea of him being anywhere near another person that way makes me sick. I mean, I don't know why he thinks he needs to do comment.
He's ill. And of course, liquor. You know, liquor seems always to be involved, or drinking seems always to be involved. Yeah. ABC7 out of California recently reported the arrest of a Fresno State college student at the fallen down drunk 23-year-old computer engineering student got busted for sneaking into the agricultural school campus and molesting a sheep. Now, see, in most of the rest of the world, that will be reported at the end of a newscast as something called a kicker. You know, or, you know, I would say something smart alecky about, well, it was at least it was California and not West Virginia, you know, whatever. But it's really not funny.
No, but, you know, I don't know, this is kind of, I'm freely associating here, Bob, but many years ago, I just happened to hear one of the football games here. I try to stay away from it. I mean, I'm happy when other people like football. I, you know, I like Star Trek. Other people like Star Trek and football. It doesn't matter to me. But sometimes I just try to stay away from it because once it gets on a certain scale, it competes with academics, and I'm hostile to it immediately. But I was listening to what's it called, the broadcast of one of our football games, and Pat Roberts, for some reason, was sitting by, what do you call the person who announces the plays, the person who is telling people on the radio what's happening on the field, whatever that person is called. Pat Roberts is sitting by him, and at some point, Pat Roberts, a U.S. senator, is saying, because some play went wrong or Kansas State wasn't doing well, he said, well, we need to get a paddle prod after those boys. And I'm like,
no, what? Really?
What? I mean, right on the radio, and I hardly ever listen to local news or football, but I was like, really? I know that could be taken as just a farm saying, you know, like, I don't know, just some.
No, I don't think, get it, no.
I mean, but you see what you're hearing what I'm hearing.
I mean, if it's a farm saying, you know, we need to chase those boys down with an elastrator.
Or maybe like a cowboy throws his lasso and lassos someone. But, I mean, we're talking about a bunch of young men running around together. That's how I look at it. And then Pat Roberts, who's too old and weak to, I mean, I'd like to see him run around to see if he has any energy left in him. I don't, I'm not too fond of the man. Then he says that. I'm like, well, you know, and then I feel vindicated. I turn off the radio. Well, this is why I don't like football. This is just problem, you know.
Yeah, this is probably the wrong part of the program for me to mention that my beloved Mountaineers will be hosting your Kansas State Wildcats this Thursday at Mountaineer Field.
Bob, I don't care if you say that. I mean, I hope they have a good time. I don't care who wins. I'm really telling
you. Oh, and by the way,
I hope you win. How's that? Because
well, God love you, Diane. That's downright ecumenical of you.
That's not generous of me because I don't care about it.
I have to share with you because celebrating your marvelous coherence, I just got a note from Carol.
Oh, Carol.
Who immediately asks because of previous conversations we've had here, and you know how the right wing is. Carol asks, what was the sheep wearing?
Well, that's a
and if you can't question. Call it, if you can't call a sheep, is it still a cat call or is it a you call or a sheep call?
That's a good question. Only Carol would see. Oh,
and when they
does sheep wear anything? I mean, this is they don't wear anything, do they?
No.
I'm not missing the.
There is that famous scene in Woody Allen's Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid to Ask, that uh-huh. features a sheep in like a bra and panties and garter belt and nylons.
No.
But we won't go any further into that.
Okay.
The person got busted, the 23-year-old computer engineering student, and when he got busted, he said that he drank an unknown amount of alcohol because he was stressed out about midterms.
Yeah. Well, that's life, isn't it? You know, these kids are under a lot of stress. And by the way, I think that's a violation of the sheep's rights. And I'm not just saying that flippantly. I think that's horrible. I mean, I think that's a horrible abuse of an animal.
Yes.
It's really, I mean, really. Anyway, but yeah, I think these kids do get stressed out. I remember when I was in school, I didn't work, or maybe I worked at the front desk answering the phones at the sorority, for the sorority. I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, I'm just like, you know, having a college life. And these kids, Oh, they might be working two jobs. They're loaned up. I mean, they are under a lot of stressors.
I think the stress probably, and this is not in any way to excuse conduct of the sort that we have been discussing, but I think that they are stressed probably more than we were, Diane.
Oh,
because one, tuition was not nearly as expensive. Two, at least for my era, there were things like, you know, grants that weren't necessarily loans. There were scholarships that, you know, the most worst could happen to you is you screw up your grade point average and you lose the scholarship.
Yeah.
But thanks to the GOP and, of course, its usual cadre of fifth columnist Democratic enablers, we turned over the student loan finance business to predatory banks. I mean, that's why we talk about student debt in the same breath as we talk about, say, subprime mortgages and the real estate bubble and credit default swaps.
Well, last I heard, the government makes what, $1 billion a year from student loans. And the Senate was bragging about, the senators, U.S. senators were at some point bragging about a bill they passed to reduce the student loan rate. And as I recall, they reduced it to, it was really high after they reduced it, like maybe 8%.
Yeah, this is crazy stuff.
Well, you know, I'm not an unhappy person. I'm really not. I have a nice life. I'm happy most every minute of the day. I'm personally happy, unless, you know, at some point on your program, I had to censor myself from saying what I wanted to have happen to the elite. So, I mean, I have my moments of just wanting to smash something, but I'm happy while I'm thinking it. I don't know. I'm generally happy, but I think, and yet at the same time, I am unhappy about living in a culture that treats its elderly and its young so abysmally, and its sheep. But we'll leave that aside for the moment.
Nice aside there, Diane. What an example of marvelous coherence that just was.
No. I feel like I do a little bit of free association when I talk with you, and you're just really nice about it. And then the coherence, I think that's a quest I will undergo, because that's a nice
I tell goal. You, we're printing T-shirts.
Well, I have an idea for your program. Before I mention it, I just want to finish up that I do think, and I think probably there are anthropologists out there who would agree to this, and it's been said before, I'm sure. I think one can judge a society in part by how it treats its elderly and very young.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's not anything brainy to say. That's just kind of common sense. And when I look at what this society is doing overall in its institutions and bragging about it, or, you know, and we could add to that the sick and the infirm. We could add to that a long list. I mean, we're really not very nice here at all. I just can't buy into thinking of us as a people as
this is further proof that, you know, I will never be in politics, because we've got an archive of every loopy, loony, crazy thing, angry, frustrated, whatever, that I've ever said. But this is a brutal nation. It is. When you're hanging up 22-year-olds with $100,000 debts, when 4 years before they were making, you know, at best minimum wage and 20 hours a week working at the donut shop or whatever. Man, isn't that just prosaic? You know, what are we thinking? Meanwhile, the Nordic countries like Germany, maybe some of the other European schools, I don't know, Japan, Australia, going to university is not nearly the financial the financial juggernaut that it is in the United States. But then again, I think in many ways, Diane, we ran out of stuff to turn over to capitalism. And so some Republicans said, "Hey, look at all those colleges."
Horrible.
And some ranking member on the Senate committee, the Senate Banking Committee, said, "You know, I got some boys that might be interested in this."
Yeah, we're not taking care to constrain capitalism.
And then this is an opportunity for us to be the little liberal arts nerds that we are. We turn around and we start treating, first of all, you've got the proliferation of for-profit higher education. DeVry,
oh,
University
bad.
Of Phoenix, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This is all just draw Spunky on the back of the matchbook and send it in attempts at education.
Yeah.
But we've got all that. But at the same time, we also have the proliferation of this notion, and I know Dr. John would chime in on this if he were listening live. I think he's been rather busy lately. But we've got this notion that higher education needs to be trade school.
And I don't say
trade school as some sort of pejorative. I say it that there are different modalities of education.
Yeah, trade school has its place. Internships have their place.
I think apprenticeships, absolutely.
It's a good system, apprenticeships, yeah.
The construction trades union apprenticeship programs are nothing short of fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to learn, and it doesn't preclude taking college courses.
No, but if on the other hand, I remember a story Dr. John gave us from several years ago, or a couple of years ago, the assault on anthropology departments in the state of Florida.
Oh, God.
The state of Florida wanted to de-emphasize all anthropology departments, and then there was another university that was just wiping out its foreign language department.
The number of
colleges and universities now that teach Latin and Greek is minuscule compared to even a generation ago. And all of these things teach critical thinking skills. You were talking about, you know, the real radical subversive or inquiry into forbidden areas of thought is going on in English departments.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love it. That's where a lot of the neo-Marxists are. But, you know, there is another trend, if I do say so myself, and I was part of it. I mean, there are those of us who did liberal arts and social science, and then we looked around and we thought, well, we'll go into, one of the professional schools because, you know, our social science will serve us well there because the people who founded business schools, a lot of them were economists, PhD economists, and, you know, I mean, where else would they come from, you know, what I'm saying? Social scientists flooded business schools, and so now that's where a lot of us are. I mean, and there's no secret about that, but it's not that I'm happy about that either, but it just kind of leads to a de-energizing of those other wonderful, you know, departments that should be on campus. I mean, I don't know where they're teaching Marxist theory anymore. I had a big dose of it along the way, and
I think you just find little pockets of it. I have a friend who describes herself as a feminist Marxist Wiccan, and
oh,
she happens to be tucked away with tenure in an academic institution, and she is an absolute joy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've had other discussions where, you know, if you use the word Marxist, then the number of people who go tune out is huge, because
there's a lot of neo-Marxist theory and organizational behavior. And that's a huge part of the Academy of Management, which is a huge, you know, conference for business scholarship. So it's there.
Well, the funny thing about Marx is that to sit down and read Marx, let's put it this way. maybe you would like to perform this experiment sometime with your students. Take big chunks of Marx. Remove all references that could in any way possibly mark it out as being Marx, and just say, here's some novel economic theory. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to take Engels first, but...
But you see what I'm saying? If you take away the stigma, because we're still dealing with the, the rabid anti-communist stigma of the 1950s, going all the way back to the Russian Revolution. And you can't get... Marxist? What? Why do they hate America?
As a matter of fact, in the text I teach from, and I ended up choosing the text that the other professors decided to use also, and it's a text on, you know, business and society and ethics and stakeholder management and that kind of thing. There's a chapter on employee stakeholders, and it's going through some language that some scholars have applied, like what's moral management, what's immoral management, what's amoral management. And the immoral management, I can see it clearly.
Don Blankenship?
Yeah. Oh, my students couldn't find a low enough level of moral reasoning to assign to him,
ooh,
by the way. But it, in terms of immoral management, the language was use of employees as means of production to be exploited. And the students don't recoil from that, but, you know, it's very Marxist. I mean, my God in heaven. But, I mean, it's in the text, but it's not, going along with what you said, it's not labeled Marxist. But I do tell them that this is Marxist language because it's university. Why shouldn't they know that?
Well, absolutely, and I'm not challenging that. I think the larger point is that it's hard to teach it. I mean, why shouldn't kids in high school read some Marx?
Oh, I don't know why not, but see, I think it goes deeper than that. I mean, I think they should read Hegel first, you know, because to understand Marx's materialistic, you know, his materialism, I mean, both of those theories have like an internal contradiction that yields something else, you know? And I just
Hey, Diane, Diane, let's just all fly to Frankfurt and live happily ever after.
Well, I mean, I just think to explore those kinds of ideas and how people have put them forth, like, you know, synthesis, like a system can go into synthesis at some point, and here's the logic why. I mean, why shouldn't they be exposed to that as early as they can possibly understand it? Because they could become good systems thinkers if they were, you know, I'm thinking of what Sandra said when she called in. Yay, Sandra, call in some more! You know, what she was saying the other night about just being able to be a systems thinker would do away with a lot of this nonsense that is blathered about in the...
But you know what? Keeping people from being that is a full-time job. And don't think that the American consumer structure isn't going hammer and tongs 24 hours a day trying to make sure that it doesn't happen. Oh, dear. I think we have lost... Diane, are you there? I don't know. Maybe Diane's phone battery went dead or something. Let's run over to the Skype line real quick. Oh, by the way, before I do that, a lot of notes coming in regarding education. Robert in Australia says, going to uni in Oz is becoming like the U.S., thanks to Tony Abbott, which means fewer Australians will go to university, leaving the spots open for overseas students, which is where the money is, sadly. Meanwhile, Sergi points out education costs in other countries, even in South Africa. The most expensive university there is $3,000 for the entire 4 years, not per year. And then, of course, there's all the free education in Europe because they think it would be really neat to have, an educated student body. And bear in mind, of course, also that our idea, unless I've got this completely wrong, Our idea of university is wildly different from the rest of the world. A lot of the rest of the world wants to come here to university, so much so that, I remember when a Japanese concern purchased a little struggling, dying liberal arts college in West Virginia and saved it and used it as a means by which to expose Japanese students to the American academic experience. Once again, the best academic experience in the world. But one of the larger differences being that, if I understand correctly, let's say, you know, there's no, there might be clubs, athletic clubs, but entire universities are not driven by their athletic departments, just as starters. Let's run over to the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program, Tim. Hello, Tim.
Oops, sorry, Bob. I was on mute.
Okay.
sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, I love the conversation you had with Diane. She was awesome.
She always is. She is, in fact, marvelously coherent.
Oh, wow. And then she brought up a question about the Ku Klux Klan. She goes, oh, my gosh, they're still around and doing their stuff. Well, I got a bit of a good news for her and for everyone else. Anonymous is going after them.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that at the beginning of the program, going after them with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw something a little bit ago that, people are clearing out their Facebook and Twitter accounts with a will because of all the Klan behavior, and they're afraid Anonymous is going to out them for the little bedclothes wearers that they are.
And I think one or two websites were taken over, a couple Twitter accounts were taken over, and they have a photo of a Klan being hanged.
Yeah, that's the signature photo of the hashtag OpKKK.
Yep.
And then that photo went viral. I got some issues with it, with that image. From the standpoint, Tim, of two wrongs don't make a right, but two rights did make an airplane. but no, I mean, if we find the images of lynching to be disgusting, why are they less so if it's a photograph of a Klansman being lynched?
True. But I believe it was due to taunting.
No, the Klan did taunt, and then Anonymous came back and just smacked him.
But as a
person who tries to espouse and live by principles of nonviolence, eliminationist imagery is wrong. And so while I engaged in a little bit of glee at the beginning of the program about what was being done, and even mentioned the photograph itself, the idea of trafficking in eliminationist imagery is deeply disturbing.
I guess I have kind of a mixed feeling about that, though. But I guess it's the way I was brought up, in a sense. Well, I mean, the way I grew up.
I mean, obviously, they did not go out. Anonymous did not go out and find a Klansman and lynch him. Okay.
No.
But it is a manifestation, I would say, it's a manifestation of desire. It is saying that we are figuratively going to lynch you on the internet.
And I'm trying
not to be a concern troll here, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
But really?
I guess I have mixed feelings about that, though. I mean, again, I don't like lynching of anybody, but when someone says we're going to, you know, kill or shoot or defend ourselves,
you still there? Did you accidentally mute yourself, Tim? Oh, Tim. Some call him Tim. And no, apparently we have lost him. There's a problem with the signal. But with 20 minutes to go in the program, I want to put something out there for your consideration. It came in via, hold on. Okay, are you back?
Huh?
Are you back?
I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, there's a Japanese word for this, and it's called bachi, which means punishment you deserve. So I guess their perspective is, Anonymous's perspective is, they're getting the punishment they deserve by cyber attacking them. You know, by principle, it's wrong.
I don't know. I think Diane might jump in and ask whether that is, you know, whether that's a bright line ethical wrong to subject people who have already invited scrutiny upon themselves, whether it's wrong to take them up on their offer. Now, if you're just out there doing this to anonymous, you know, just walk of life people because you can, obviously that's wrong. I don't know that I'm not willing to say that what Anonymous did to the Klan was wrong. Now, if Anonymous was walking down the street and just gunning down Klansmen, within the principles of nonviolence, that's wrong. I'm talking about using eliminationist imagery. For instance, Fox put up a graphic that showed a generic person labeled liberal hanging from a noose. Would any of us have any problem manifesting outrage about that?
Yeah, there would be.
And it would be justified, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so eliminationist imagery is eliminationist imagery.
But even though the image is supposed to represent hatred and violence. And
yeah, you're representing your hatred of hatred. Yay, somebody didn't win.
Huh.
I mean, all you have to do with that image is substitute any oppressed group for the Klansman hanging there, and nobody's going to have any problem saying that that image is wrong. But I challenge the Horn Family Commune congregation and others to look at that image of the lynched Klansman and ask if that's okay. Is it okay because we don't like the Klan? Is it okay because the Klan has earned a good representation of a lynching? You know, nobody's lynching Klansmen. The Klan really did lynch real live innocent individuals. No, you know, there's no doubt there. But when we adopt their imagery, when we adopt their messaging tactics, to some degree or another, do we not become like them?
Even if it's an effigy.
How would you feel about an effigy of a Japanese American if you walked out on your lawn and found it hanging from a tree? How would you feel? And I'm not trying to touch a sore spot, Tim, but you know, if it was mailed to you as a Photoshop job like this was, see what they have done with this image, and I think about this both from a legal structure standpoint, and an emotional standpoint, and a messaging standpoint. What they've done with this image is to give the other side fodder to say, See that image? It says right there, Op KKK. They're coming for us. And thus you have not walked. You have run down off the moral high ground.
Into amoral or immoral?
We'll leave that to Diane. I think my guess is it would be amoral.
Yeah, I agree. Because it's a representation, and this is just coming from me as a person of color, that the representation is not the person behind or underneath the suit, but the suit itself. But I got to understand where you're coming from, because regardless.
Oh, I'm not putting this out there as some sort of threatened white person. That's not it at all. And I may get emails saying, Bob, you're just dead wrong about this. I mean, we need more images of lynched Klansmen. But if we are not to be as nasty as they are, it might be wise if we did not adopt their tactics.
But hacking their sites and taking down their Twitter accounts, the websites.
They invited that. They invited. They said, they're a bunch of wannabes. They can't do nothing to us. So, they, you know, it's the same thing as when, you remember Gary Hart, right?
Who?
Gary Hart?
Yeah.
Presidential candidate?
Yeah.
And there was a lot of smoke, and people suspected there was fire. And so he said, well, the media's free to follow me around. And the media took him at his word, and the next thing you know, there's photographs of him canoodling with some woman on the monkey business. Because the goddess of irony never rests.
Yeah. Speaking of goddess of irony, there was, I think, the host or someone else who's a member of the KKK said that, told Anonymous, give us back our site or we're going to go to the FBI and demand our site back.
Right. And if you're the FBI, you say, oh, this is terrible, obviously. we're going to have to investigate this for a real long time. This is a very complex case.
Because anyway, Anonymous isn't just in the United States. I have a feeling these...
No, it's a global collective.
Yeah,
and it's also structureless and largely leaderless.
Right. So I said, so I commented back that how do you know it's in the USA? How do you know it isn't Anonymous Israel, Anonymous China, Anonymous Mexico? You don't know.
No, you don't. Anonymous France, Anonymous Germany, Anonymous Iceland, Anonymous Canada. Sure.
Could be white folks, too.
you know what? Absolutely it could be. Because there's lots of white folks. Hi, I'm one. Who thinks the Klan is odious, disgusting, revolting, nauseating, sickening, running out of participles? Yeah. Hey Tim, I'm gonna roll because I want to make sure and try to get it. There's another line waiting over on the Gizmo line, so I'm gonna try to get.
Thank
to
you very much, Bob San. Thank you very much.
Arigato, Tim San.
Arigato. Bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Tim calling from L.A. Hey, welcome to the program. Okay, I hear my replay in your background. Would you care to join the call? Hello? Hello? Okie dokie. So, note coming in from our buddy Horst. Lynching imagery, subject line. For my two bits, I have no qualms about eliminationist imagery used against the Klan. I haven't seen the picture in question, but to me, an image of a Klan member as a victim of a lynching is a clear and unmistakable example of satire turning a Klan practice on its head and showing them as the victim of their own behavior. It makes a statement that operates on a level entirely separate than calling for the violent elimination of an adversary. I don't see any possible way of taking it for anything other than what it is, which is a simple role reversal used to generate cognitive dissonance and irony. I would, however, be much more worried about offending the sensibilities of blacks and others who have traditionally been the targets of lynching, which is kind of my point, and those who have lived with or loved ones who have lived with the fear of lynching. For that reason alone, I would steer clear of such images. But the Klan? F 'em. And I don't care if they take this image as some kind of example of hate speech. It's pathetically transparent for them to do so. They didn't get famously associated with hangings by accident. No, they didn't. And Horst, I share your assessment of F 'em. And, you know, to what extent does any picture of any lynching not call to mind and perhaps serve as a trigger for people who have been threatened thereby? It's the rope, not the person at the end of it. If I could make that argument. And as we wrap up the program, a reminder that this evening has been a have a show on me from Roger, who encourages people to take action now to make sure. And, you know, this could easily be done on a national level. Take action now to make sure that people who have and whose only form of photo ID is a Veterans Administration photo ID. Roger proposes the following: until such time as the dignity of the person is restored, I would like to ask active duty members of the armed forces whose ID is considered valid in these localities to work on restoring dignified treatment of those who served with them or before them. Other groups can mount similar campaigns for their disaffected comrades. When you attend a political function or any place that politicians will be present, do so in uniform. Ask your politicians what their position is on your state's law regarding rejecting veterans' ID for voter ID purposes. Do not tell them what they should say. Ask them to explain on the record what their position is. Please do not wait like the faux opposition groups that pretend to object to laws but always show up with too little too late to make a difference until a few weeks before an election to start doing this. There's another national election coming in a little less than 2 years. This, suggests Roger, would be the time to get started on something of this nature. And thank you, Roger, for providing the have a show on me this evening. We are well into tomorrow evening's fundraising. And I can tell you, as we come toward the close of the program, what we will be working on tonight and into tomorrow is a note that I got from Steve. Steve says, the horn is 9 years old. So, it would hold that I would do a $90 challenge. However, this is a one-to-grow-on challenge. There's a $100 challenge, $10 for every year, and Steve says he will match the first $100 that come in on his one-to-grow-on challenge. Steve adds, I like this idea of getting out in front of the fundraising, so it's not quite so sweaty quite so often. 7 minutes or so remaining in the program. I do encourage you to, and I'm loath to do this, but WashingtonExaminer.com, I hate for them to have the traffic, but this is an interesting, it's just interesting for no other reason than the sociological factor of it. WashingtonExaminer.com, the decline and fall of coal. And, of course, it's a lengthy article, and it doesn't say anything about the 24 studies that show that mountaintop removal is poisoning and killing innocent innocent people living nearby. But, of course, there is a reference a little further down the story to a fellow by the name of Delegate Rupi Phillips. Oh, okay, maybe I'm wrong about all of this. Texas Betsy says there's nothing wrong with the Examiner these days. Maybe I'm completely wrong in thinking this is a right-wing periodical. Just looking at the... Shut down, GOP has a better strategy. Are unions obsolete? How badly did Wendy Davis lose? Then Ray Lujan named new DCCC chairman. A conservative case for universal coverage. I don't know, maybe, okay, so maybe I was wrong all the way around. But this part did grab me. Delegate Rupi Phillips, a Democrat, says, we've got to get our drugs cleaned up. We have an epidemic here. It's pathetic. It's true. And the article notes, Phillips is driving his black Chevy Tahoe through the autumn-hued mountains of southern West Virginia. His back seat is filled with the trappings of campaign life, dress shoes, a hard hat from his job selling coal, the two propane tanks he picked up for a barbecue he's hosting for the fire department. Everyone knows Phillips. What makes him a Democrat is anyone's guess. He's for Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. He's against government handouts, and his campaign card states simply, guns, coal, jobs, God. He was initially skeptical about hosting the Examiner. We've had some reporters want to come down here and go in the mines, and then it turns out they were tree huggers, he says during an initial phone call. Anyway, it's a fascinating article. And if I was wrong in calling them a right-wing publication, I apologize sincerely, because them's fighting words where I come from. No, they're not. So go and have a read. We'll wrap things up. John Fox sent me a cartoon from The Guardian, from the Comet is Free page. It's a strip called First Dog on the Moon, and I see he sends it to me periodically, and this is wonderful. Well worth going and looking at. Belinda and Simone catch up after the weekend. It's a pair of koalas talking to each other after the G20 summit in, Brisbane? Sharp and biting satire. First Dog on the Moon, koalas at the G20. So look up First Dog on the Moon, koalas at the G20. You will enjoy it. So thanks very much, one and all, for the time that you share in this little community. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for your emails. Thanks for your tweets. Thanks for your Facebook postings. You make this a wonderful 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week multimedia extravaganza. More than that, you make this a community. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Lottie and Texas Betsy, moderators in the Horn chat room, which John tells me will get squared away in short order. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol Baker. Thank you to John Fox for all that he does, both with the website and with the technical demons with which I routinely deal here. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Remember, nothing happens here without the good offices of the White Rose. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.